Wisp Sports Radio, the voice of women in sport.
Thank you for downloading Tucker Center Talks. This is season 2, episode 20. Listening to Tucker Center Talks, a podcast from the Tucker Center for Research on Girls and Women in Sport at the University of Minnesota and a co-production with Wisp Sports. I'm your host for Tucker Center Talks, Dr. Nicole Lavoie, director of the Tucker Center. In this podcast, I will talk to Dr. Jasmine George Williams, or as we have come to know each other, as Dr. G. She is an activist, sociocultural higher education practitioner, and an assistant professor at the University of Laverne. She has earned numerous degrees, including a bachelor's in psychology from Cal State University of Los Angeles, a master's in college counseling and student development, and a master's in educational counseling, both from the University of Laverne, and a PhD in higher education from Azusa Pacific University. And all that great education is going to inform what she is going to talk to us today about, which is her labor of love, her work on the athlete growth activism model. Welcome, Dr. G.
Dr. Nicole, hello. Good to be here with you.
Absolutely. So Dr. G was a recent panelist for the Tucker Center Distinguished Lecture Series that was held on October 19th and the fall of 2020. And she and four other colleagues talked about their work from multiple perspectives on Black women in sport and voices of resistance and athlete activism. And it was wildly popular. We have gotten unending amounts of positive feedback. And one of the things that people kept saying is every single panelist needs their own distinguished lecture. So this podcast is a way of flushing out these ideas more in depth and giving you some time and space to tell people about your work, because people are really curious to know. So why don't you tell us a little bit about what is the activist growth model? And how did it come to be?
Well, thanks for having me again. And it was so much fun being in that space on the 19th. And I'm so glad we were all able to come together with the timing, which of course I'll share about a little later, why that date was so important and clutch, and I appreciate it. The AGM, the Activism Growth Model, literally a labor of love in so many ways. I would have to say it really probably started, as I reflect back, maybe childhood, right? You know, as we continue to grow and reflect, we start to think about the building blocks that happened when we were younger and certain things in our life. And so I grew up only girl in the middle, two boys, two brothers, and I played sports. And when I think about it, my dad actually put me in basketball when I was six. He lied about my age. I was supposed to be eight. And when I think about just how sports informed my lens, and it really, it was such a way at how I approached life. I'm a point guard, and so you know it's the quarterback of the team. You have to make sure you're taking care of everybody. You got to make the best decisions, and you know, and things of that nature. And so that spilled onto every aspect of my life. And so as I continue to grow and play basketball and coach, and now in this space of being, you know, a grown-up in my PhD program, I started to really reflect on my past and my life. Both my parents have since passed on. My dad passed when I was 10. And I remember looking through, you know, our garage and finding all this kind of pro-Black paraphernalia, not really understanding it, asking my mom and my aunts and my finding out that my dad was a former member of the Black Panther Party for self-defense. And you see these things and you're like, huh, you know, because you're a youngster, so you don't really get it, and seeing these books. And so growing up, I looked just like my mom, but I have the inner workings of my dad. And so all that came back in my PhD, in my PhD studies. And I knew I always wanted to do my dissertation on Black athletes in some way, shape, or form. So, you know, it's always good. You're starting, you know, if you want to start a doctoral program, it's advantageous to have some sort of passion about a particular population. It does not have to stay that way, but it's good, you know, to say, hey, I think I want to be interested in, you know, this population. But I have to tell you what happened during that time from when I was in the academic realm and what was happening within me and in society was this just beautiful divine crash. And I have to tell you, you know, with the date that we are speaking now, I think of 2016. So it was the ASH conference. It's that stands for the Association of the Study of Higher Ed. And in our PhD program, that's one of the conferences that we have to go to. So 2016, November of 2016, I voted and I got on a plane with one of my best friends in the cohort. And I'm literally on the plane and there's a guy a couple seats down. He's watching the election unfold. And so I'm leaning and looking at the numbers. And we were going to Columbus, Ohio. And so, which is a red state from what I can recollect. And as we're seeing the numbers unfold, and I'm saying, oh my God. And so my best friend, CG, she at the time had like, you know, a 6 and an 8-year-old. I don't want to wake her up. She didn't sleep. So I'm going through the process of grief of like, is this happening? And then I have to watch one of my best friends go through that same process too. And think of what am I going to tell when she wakes up? What am I going to tell my kids? Because she's Latina. So that's a whole extra layer, right? Of what am I going to tell my babies? So we land in this red state. And the energy is so thick and uncomfortable. And this conference, this academic conference, completely changed. The energy changed. And we found ourselves at a rally, at a protest, me and my classmates, and it was electric. And it was life-changing because we were all in this space together, Columbus 2016. And I found myself the next morning having breakfast with my dissertation chair, Alex. And I said, Alex, I know what I want to do my dissertation on. I want to capture the lived experiences of Black college athletes who identify as activists in this time of social and racial injustice. And he was like, gee, you got it. So at that time, you know,
we like to call that a sticky idea.
Oh my God. And he just looked and he said, that's it. And because he knew me, he had me in class and just my passion. When I start talking about activism, there's a vein that pops up and all that stuff. And he was like, that's it. And from then on, that sharp purpose and focus was so illuminated. And so that was happening in this field of sports. So it was the, you know, University of Missouri. There was a young lady at another institution that was, you know, engaging in activism. There were the cheerleaders at Kennesaw State. All these things were happening. And then of course, Colin Kaepernick, you know, at the professional realm. And then you see, you know, the local students that are doing their thing and what's happening. And then I think, what would I have done, you know, as a college athlete or as a coach during that time? And so that was happening in society. There were personal things that were taking place in my life. Like I think I talked about it on the talk, where my mother was, she was sick. She was diagnosed with Alzheimer's and dementia. And so that personal injustice of the reality of like, life is not fair sometimes. So feeling that, grieving what's happening in society as to why, you know, activism has continued to swell. And then figuring out what am I gonna do with all of this feelings of love,
where's
rage,
my place?
Passion.
Yeah.
Where's my place? I have so much energy. They would, you know, I guess they say I'm an empath. I feel everything. And I'm like, how am I going to put this energy into good? And so that was my dissertation in which I did create something for stakeholders called the BAL model, the Black Athlete Activist Leadership Model. And those are for people that are working with, who want to learn more, who want to engage and empower Black athlete activists and also activists of color. But the AGM, I always wanted to build something for the people, like I said, for the activists, because I am them and they are me, feeling all of this rage, feeling all of this hurt and pain, and you wanting to do something, but have no idea how, why, where, whom to engage, safely engage in your activism. And so that's how the AGM was birthed, and building something for the people. Yeah.
You know, what I really am impressed about this model, and you'll tell us a little bit more about the theoretical underpinnings and the research that helped you build the thinking around it, is that you start from a place of, this is my passion and this is my calling. And how do I use research to create social change and help others? And to me, that's what research is about. It should be about, not that it always is, but that's my personal philosophy as well. And I just love that you can tell your story, because for other scholars listening, and young scholars in particular, when they're struggling, I don't know what I'm going to do my dissertation on. It's lonely. It's hard. It's long. And, you know, nobody understands what the heck you're doing. except for you and maybe a significant other if they get it, but they may not. And, you know, how do you do the work and something that lights you up and that sustains you? So I just love this model so much. So tell us about I know there's 5 studies that sort of, you interview different stakeholder groups to build the qualitative, rich lived experiences of this model, on top of kind of 4 theoretical frameworks. So what I love about this model is that it's complex.
Yeah.
But it works.
It right, works. Right.
Like, you look at it, and we'll have a link to it in the podcast, and you can, and to your webinar on it. So yeah, tell us about how you came to build it out.
Right. So I started to reflect. So I graduated, earned my PhD in 2019. And so I think I was probably in a faculty training. I should have been paying attention. And this rush of just ideas and thoughts kind of came over me, where and things were, of course, racial and social injustice was still continuing to happen. So I don't know if it was a particular thing that was taking place in society that had my mind just in other places that wasn't in the faculty setting. But I remember I was just jotting down things that I wish I would have known, or things that helped me in my journey throughout my growth in activism. And I was like, huh. And they were all very distinct things that I can build on. So you should see the paper. It's somewhere around here. It was just a beautiful mind. It was all over the place. And so what I learned and appreciated in my PhD program was, I'm a qualitative researcher. And so, you know, there's qualitative and quantitative, and I respect both realms, but I found myself more in qualitative, centering and honoring the narratives of folks. We know in higher education, we know in society, that some narratives are silenced or aren't as valid, right? For some reason. And so my goal as a person that identifies with a few of those marginalized communities is, I have a sense of privilege being in an academic space where I can do more with this dissertation, I can do more with my furthering the research than it to just sit on my shelf. And so I knew, in order to do that, right? I mean, it's here. It's right here. I got it right here. it's dusty shelf.
We all
shelf.
Have the dusty shelf.
Right. I'm like, I need to, anyway. And so I said, in order to do that, I have to continue to build. And so after, after I graduated, I reached out to loved ones from different universities. I kept in contact with a few of the Black College Athlete activists from my dissertation, and they are thriving and doing some great things. So went back and met back with them. Hey, you know, you were a freshman when I met you. How has life changed, you know, now that you're a senior? You're graduated. What are you doing in grad school? And hearing about their growth. So that was the foundation of kind of going back to the drawing board with the BCAAs, right? Black College Athlete Activists. Then the other studies was 30 Black student leaders. Some of them identified as activists or athletes, but they all identified as activists in one way, shape, or form. They held leadership roles at a small, medium-sized West Coast institution. Then there were Black athletes and student leaders. There were 27 of them, and that was at a smaller faith-based institution. Then there was something called an autoethnography. That's the study of oneself. So looking back on recordings, reading my journals, looking at my composition books when I was studying, you know, working with the student athletes and the college athletes. And then lastly was a group of six doctoral students of color, women, who were my close girlfriends in our cohort. So there were seven of us out of a cohort of 12. So we made history at my university in the PhD program because we were the most students of color in one cohort. So they didn't know what to do with us. So we were called the PhD dolls, right? So it was literally a study of us, which is continuing, and how they have grown into their activism in so many different beautiful ways. And so based on their narratives, many of the common themes that came together, that is how I informed, you know, what was it? Was it support? Was it barriers? How do you practice self-care, if at all? What role do you find yourself engaging in? And so that's how the roles and the tenets of AGM, all the commonalities start to come in correlation with my experience. And so I was like, oh, this is great. And then kind of figuring out where it would make the most sense, what's the most important part, gleaning from Maslow's hierarchy of needs, that foundational underpinning and what would make most sense. And I just found myself like, I think I've got something here.
Oh, you've got something. You've got something, girl.
I've got something. Yeah. And then especially with timing, you won't see, but I'm literally leaned back in the chair, gasping for breath, 37, about to be 38 weeks pregnant. And, you know, one of my vehicles of choice to engage in activism has been protesting or marching or things like that. And with the summer and with, you know, me being expecting a baby, my choice of activism was birthing Black life. And so that created that urgency to wanting to continue to contribute, especially at this time, and to sit down and really polish the AGM, because I felt that the time was now. There was such this crash of, like I said, consciousness, coronavirus, and quarantine, where a lot of people were probably feeling the same things that I were feeling. And if I can provide some sort of lighthouse, a guidepost for that, then I would have been able to contribute to this movement in ways that I haven't been able to before.
Yeah, when we first spoke, I don't know, a couple months ago, when Dr. Akila sent me your way and said, you got to talk to Dr. Jasmine George Williams. And we did, and I watched your webinar, and I immediately was drawn to the model because you do have something. It's unique. It's needed. It's practical, but it's theoretical. And I think I told you then, and I still feel that way now, is that there's so few academics that can translate theory into practical application. And you hit this one on the head, because it blends Black feminist thought and critical race theory and Maslow's hierarchy of needs. And the fourth one, theoretical framework.
Community cultural wealth. Yasso's
community cultural wealth. Tell us a little bit about that one, because I think for a lot of listeners, they, you know, like, oh, we know Maslow, and some people know Black critical thought, you know, Patricia Hira Collins and critical race theory, but that one I think is more lesser known. Tell us about that one.
I found myself falling more and more in love with this, even writing my dissertation. And sometimes, you know, when you're on a roll, you're like, I really want to incorporate this, but I don't know how. You know, you go down this rabbit hole and you're like, I have to come back to this, right? So I sprinkled it a little bit in the dissertation, but I was like, I have to come back to this because I really, really, really love this theory and this framework. And so Tara Yasso, I believe she's out of UCLA. She pretty much, this is centered in the fact that students of color come to campus with gems of strength and different assets already when they come to campus, that especially depending on the institution, the climate, these assets or strengths or gems aren't seen as such, right? And so she talks about capital. So she calls them capital. I call them gems or strengths or whatnot. So she has six of them. And as I continue to hear from my participants, from my loved ones, from those fellow activists, four of them continue to show up. How and what and whom were there that helps you grow into your activism, to help you grow into the person that you are today. And so these are, so the four that I, you know, hearken on is the aspirational capital. So, and then I think about the students that I serve, that I teach, and they talk about these things, and also the activists talk about these things. They aspire to continue to do better and be better, to honor their ancestor, to honor their family. And they're always aspiring to, not just from an academic space, but just to be a better human being. So they talked about that in one way, shape, or form. So that's the aspirational capital. The second one is family capital. And many, and all, I don't want to say all, because, you know, there, we're not a monolithic group, but in many communities of color, family is so important. I knew that when I graduated, everybody's gonna graduate. Now, I'm the one that wrote the dang dissertation, but it's a sense of pride. And so you come on a college campus, you come into this new space where you may be the first, and you think about your family. I think about my parents. I dedicated my dissertation to my parents. And it's that family capital, that family built-in support. And sometimes it's not your blood. Sometimes it could be your cousin that you grew up with. But just that family capital that students bring to campus that sometimes isn't recognized. The third one is social capital. So, you know, starting groups and being a part of different communities that, and that speaks into the finer people that will sustain you. My PhD dolls, woof, I don't know what I would do without them throughout, you know, this journey, and even my family and my spouse and things like that. So it's that social capital where these students of color, activists of color, understand the importance of that community, of the social capital coming together for the greater good. And the last one is the resistant capital. Say no more, nonetheless, we resist, right? And so as someone that is identifying as an advocate or activist, that jacket of resistance is something that they wear. And so YASO's community cultural wealth, out of the, you know, the four out of the six capitals that continue to show up in the narratives, and which I'm like, oh, I love this. So things that are innate that we bring to the table, it's celebrated, and I needed to honor and center those in the narratives. Yeah.
And I think it's interesting that you center the narratives, the ones that emerge, right? And the ones that people resonate with, and how you find your people. And one of the things of the AGM is find your people, right? I mean, I think that is might the second block, if I'm
that's actually so that, you know, it's begin your soul work is the first one. Know your role, choose your vehicles. And I intentionally put find your people right in the middle, because as you're growing, that's right. I mean, the foundation is the soul work, who you are, you're growing. But I did find your people. I put that in the middle because as you're moving forward and continue to find yourself, it is pure gold when you find your community and your people. That will sustain you as the barriers come, right? As maybe you need to, you know, work on self-care. But if you have your people, your community, that's the game changer, because it is, we're literally fighting for equity and equality. And whether you're in an academic space or not, just like as you said, Dr. Nicole, it can get lonely. And there's nothing like looking to the left and looking to the right and knowing that someone is like, I get it, or I want to get it, or I will hold you and sustain you. And that is just such a beautiful thing that I distinctively know how that feels to have it and to not. And I will take have it any day.
Yeah, you had your dolls.
I had my dolls, yeah.
For young women and men who don't have that group, they haven't found their people. This is one of the questions that came up out of our distinguished lectures. We had a lot of young people of color, academics who are in that space, that lonely doctoral space, if you will. And they wanted to know from you, like, how do you find your people?
I want to also say that, you know, I lucked out with having six sisters, right, in my program. That's like, I realized the privilege in that because we made history. So if I would have started my cohort a year before, I don't know what would have happened, right? So I recognized that there was a power in numbers in my journey that took place. Sometimes all you need is one or two folks. And, you know, as I speak about, these are women that I met in my doctoral program, but we could go days without talking about dissertation. It was just, we were together in life. We had commonalities. We presented at APU and we were all either caregivers or mothers or spouses or partners. So there were commonalities that we had, and we just so happened to be getting a PhD together, but we were walking through life. And so those individuals, your people can be a person, right? It doesn't necessarily have to be a group of folks. And, you know, ideally you would love for someone, your person, your people. I love Grey's Anatomy, so like Meredith Grey and her person. It doesn't have to be someone in an academic space. It's just someone that allows you to fall apart and pick yourself back up again. They may not understand you completely, but you feel safe with them to grow and to develop and be vulnerable. That can also be someone you have never met before. I like how technology can be used for good as opposed to rubbish, right? I even came across a lot of wonderful Facebook support groups. There's the Black Doctoral Network that I just stumbled upon, and I would be so frustrated because every year I would stumble upon, I would miss the conference by like a week. And I'm like, come on. So, but now there's virtual spaces, Facebook. I mean, I might be aging myself, but I'm on Facebook, and there's some really great support groups, especially graduate school and doctorate specific groups. Where it's people and it's just people sharing their journey. Everyone's somewhere in the spectrum of getting a doctorate degree or even a master's degree. I'm still on it, and I still encourage folks. It could be, you know, individuals, if you are part of different faith-based institutions, just whatever the case is. It doesn't have to be someone in your department or in your program. That's in a perfect world because they understand the rigor of the academic space, but I'm not just a scholar activist, you know, I need someone to hold me in other ways. What? You know, and so I really appreciate technology in that way. But in the event, as you search, don't give up. There will be those divine connections where it doesn't have to be 30 folks, but there could be one or two people that will check on you. It could be folks that you grew up with that are so proud of you that do not get it, but will text you, or maybe they do. Maybe they have a loved one that's going through something similar, but they see you. And so know that I have hope and faith. There are people coming your way that will hold you and sustain you. But in the meantime, as you're waiting for that open door at the hallway, don't give up. Don't give up, yeah.
So tell me, when you talk to people about this model, what really resonates with them? What do they tell you they like about this model, and how are they using it?
I think just as you had stated, how it's not too, I didn't want it to be too academic, too heady, because I come from a student affairs background. I'm a student affairs baby. I'm a practitioner. And so that was my main concern of not making it just so, because we've gone to conferences and we're looking at models and we're like,
what are they talking about? Looking up the dictionary.
There's 30 arrows going, and I'm like, no, that can't be me, right? Because that's just not who I am. So I really wanted it to be practical. And I think it comes from my psychology and counseling background, where I wanted to make it deeply personal, but individuals can use it to build programs. At the University of Laverne, I just did a mini, you know, webinar because the students have created an activism group. And so they're excited, but they're like, Dr. G. So I presented this to them, and I made it deeply personal. So I asked them kind of probing questions and guiding questions, and we went through the model. So I think that those that don't have the desire to, you know, have a doctorate degree or master's degree, it would still make sense to them because they want to contribute. I think that because there's theories involved, the academics will appreciate the richness of it. I think also the practitioners will appreciate the fact that, you know, my background and I took my time to even the language isn't too, quote, academic.
No, it's and very accessible.
Yeah. And that was my goal. And I think it was a beautiful blend of who I am, being a practitioner, being a student affairs professional, being a counselor, being a professor, and throwing it all in a pot and being voila. So I think that's what a lot of people have said. And like I said, I've done it, you know, with undergrads, with students, with community activists. And my goal is that anyone who needs it can take it and absorb whatever they need. And they could come back. You know, they may be in a different space. They may have be in a very healthy space, but then here comes something else that they're passionate about. Let me go back and do the soul work and see where the triggers and where the healing is. So that was my goal, for it to just not be on the shelf in one realm, but anyone who needs it can take it and it could be utilized effectively for them.
And I know they're in one level of the model, there's different roles that people can take. I think one's an agitator, a protector, a supporter. Can you just run us through the different roles? Because we can't be all of them. And maybe sometimes we're one role and not the other. We switch back and forth. But I like that aspect of the model because you can insert yourself like, ooh, that's me.
That's it. I think, so there's three kind of overarching roles that I decided. And of course, you know, you look on the internet and there's so many different names, right, for these different roles. But I said, okay, how can I, once again, wanting to simplify it, wanting it to be common language and, you know, not too heady, but there's the agitator, reformer, and change agent. So the agitator lights the match, gets things started. Right? Holds a mirror up to society, is unapologetic, pretty much puts society on blast, puts the oppressor on blast, puts white supremacy on blast, whatever we are resisting or wanting to dismantle, puts them on blast and does that in different ways, depending on the vehicle. And so they kind of get it started. And so essentially they can pass the baton, if you will. So there's no really a hierarchy of anything, but when you think about how these movements have gone, it's usually just some blast of information that we are now privy to because maybe there was a protest or something happened on social media or the news. So those are usually agitators who kind of get it started. I have the most fun in the agitator role, right? But you know, they engaging in different vehicles. And so that's the agitator. The next role is the reformer. So when I speak with either students or those in higher education, this may speak to them in one way, shape, or form, because these are individuals that have some sort of proverbial seat at the table where they are working within a system. If we're working at an institution of higher education, we are working within a system, right? And depending on our role that we have, the level of either access or our voice varies. So we are essentially at the table, working to tweak, challenge, reform, dismantle the same system we're working within, right? So as a faculty member, I'm so excited and so proud that I'm the co-lead to create a Black Studies major at our university. Now, as an alum, this should have happened years ago, but nonetheless, the time is now. And no one wants to be the institution to not pass this, right? It's not just, it's not just Black Studies, but also our Latinx major and minor. It's critical equity studies. So we are a committee of folks who we've been doing this all summer and we are so excited and it's passed. And so as a reformer, as a faculty member, my co-lead Thomas thought of me and we reached out to all these wonderful Black faculty and staff, started working with our Latinx partners. And so we have created this, it will be a department. Wow. That we're creating.
Are you gonna be the chair?
You know, they keep asking me, you know, Nicole, Dr. Nicole, I don't know. You know, it's like, whatever's for me is for me. As an alum, to just be a part of this, to say this legacy, So it's amazing. And the students need it and they deserve it and all that stuff. And the time is now. They deserve that safe space. And then I also teach the Black Experience class, right? So with the voice and the privilege that I have as a professor, I'm at the table, but I can tweak and dismantle a few things. Look at the syllabus. Where are the LGBTQIA authors? Where are the Black authors? You know what I mean? Why are these the suggested texts and not the required? So I'm at tables and I have a voice and I can ask these questions. So it could be people that have the voice or are striving to have some sort of leadership role. Those are the reformers. They desire to work in systems. Then the last is the change agent. So this usually resonates with community activists or those that aren't a part of education. They could be. These can be parents, especially now that everyone is quarantined or, you know, homeschooled to one way, shape, or form. A lot of my parent friends are looking at the homeschool curriculum and like, this is not it, you know, we don't even talk about, you know, BIPOC, you know, Black, Indigenous, people of color. And so now they are raising these questions and they are looking for resources so that they can well inform the babies, right? So these are people that work within the systems and organizations and in the community to educate and to organize. And so then there's the last is like, well, Dr. G, I kind of feel that I thrive in every role. You know, depending on where the spirit moves me, depending on, you know, what's happening in my life, I think I can do all of them. And so in the text, in the book, I call that a versatile. And these are people that I'm a versatile, but like I said, I have the most fun as an educator, but I know where I thrive and the strength. So that's a versatile, activist where they feel that they can and have thrived in all three. And they feel that they're very comfortable wherever they are needed. So it's almost like, you know, versatile player. So let's say I'm only 5'6", so that's why point guard was the only thing I could do. But let's say if I was a little taller, if I was the Magic Johnson of the, I can play all five positions.
I always thought I was going to be like 5'10". You know, I was a point guard too, and I'm 5'4". And then I never grew.
Right. Yeah. See, you feel my pain. So the WNBA, they weren't calling me is what I'm saying. But nonetheless, if, you know, we were a little taller, then, you know, they feel they're the Magic Johnson of the activism life, where they feel they can play all the positions, whatever, you know, the team needs them. So those are the three and then four roles of, you know, the AGM.
So with all this great work that you're doing in such an important time in our society, socioculturally, politically, economically, what's next? What's on the queue for this work to further get it out to the people who need it the most?
First, I'm going to have this beautiful Black baby boy.
Yes,
probably
you are.
In a
baby
week
G.
or two. Baby G, you know, that's next. But I'm actually putting together a handbook or a text, if you will, that includes both of the models. And so one of the goals is to have this being utilized for a textbook. So, you know, in our program, I created like an activism social conscious class. And so that will be, you know, my hope is one of the main textbooks, and it's a handbook. So as we break down the roles, there's calls to action. There's different questions that I encourage the readers to continue to investigate about themselves and just with each tenet. And I give a little bit of the history of activism, Black campus activism. And so that will be the first part, really breaking down and giving more of just fleshing through the AGM. And the second part is really breaking down the BAL model, the Black Athlete Activist Leadership Model. So this can be, that second part can be for people that maybe work within systems, that work with athletes, and maybe don't even identify as activists, but hey, I wanna learn more. how can I, you know, engage, empower, and work with Black athletes and also activists of color? So that's what's next. We've sent the draft to my editor and working on that. So that's what's around the, you know, the corner, continuing to do, you know, different webinars, but in the near future, of course, I'm jumping into the new adventure of mommyhood, but the text in the book, that's what's next. And of course, you know, social media, me sharing, you know, different things, but that's what's on the horizon for me and for the AGM.
You have an exciting year ahead and lots of good stuff to come for you ahead. And I so appreciate you taking the time to be on the podcast to tell us more about your really important work. And if I could pre-order your book or handbook, I'm in, right? I'm in. And I think many who are listening will join me because it's great information that we're looking for. And so thank you so much for the work you do, for the human, the beautiful human that you are and that you will give birth to. We can't wait to meet baby G.
Yes. Me too. I need him to come on. Yeah.
So any final thoughts as we wrap up? Anything you want to make sure you let the listeners know that we didn't get to?
You know, we had a good time. I'm just, once again, just really appreciative to I love just the connection. Just when women get together, there isn't anything we can't do. I just so appreciative with Dr. Akila for thinking of me, for connecting us, you know, and that's how you keep paying it forward. And just had a really good time on the 19th. If those that are interested in, you know, just learning more about what I've got going, I'm not too much, I'm more on Instagram, you know, and, or actually you can just follow, everyone's got the link tree. So I guess I'll share that and you know, touch on all the socials, but it's linktr.ee / Dr. Jasmine. So DR, and then for those that are reading the way that my name is spelled, it's so fun. Thanks, Mom and Dad. Dr. Jasmine. So linktr.ee /DRGYASMINE. Dr. G.
And we'll have that link down in the show notes below as well, so people can find you and your great work and your webinar and follow you on social and just keep in touch with the all the good things you're doing. So thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. I'll see you in 2021 with the extra friend with me.
You absolutely will. So as we conclude this episode of Tucker Center Talks, I'd love to hear from you. So tweet me at Dr. Sports Psych or at Tucker Center. Check out our website at tuckercenter.org where you can find the distinguished lecture series that Dr. G and I were talking about. And follow us on Facebook or Instagram. You can find the show notes with links and resources for this episode at wispsports.com. Look for the Tucker Center Talks under the Listen tab, where you will find more conversations from the world of women's sport. Thank you for listening and helping us turn up the volume on women's sport. That's a wrap for Tucker Center Talks. I'll be back in 2 weeks' time. I'm your host, Dr. Nicole Lavoie, signing off to make a difference in the lives of girls and women in sport.